welcome to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Chris Hickey. Coming up, a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. We cover several topics, but let me first start by giving you a disclaimer. When we went into recording this podcast, I had a bit of a technical error for the first 6 minutes, and our normal intro and ensuing discussion is lost for good. But do not fear, the remaining 85% of the podcast is in order. This week, our Morning Edition host and reporter Sarah Weitz-Kotacek joins us, as well as Jacob Kaufman, a reporter and All Things Considered host. Some of the topics we covered this week: shakeups at DHS, the State Department of Human Services. The state child welfare director announced that she's resigning. We'll talk about that, as well as a report showing negligence at the Boonville Human Development Center. And we'll also pose the question of when the agency will get new leadership at the top. After that, we talk a little bit about the politics of sentencing and how a couple of U.S. Senate candidates from Arkansas view mandatory minimums. And the Arkansas Medical Board this week made some changes to key terms in the state's regulations on abortions. We'll have an examination of the reasons behind this decision and how it might sit with Republican lawmakers. And finally, we talk about Teach for America expanding into Little Rock schools. It has the backing of the governor and business, but do the program's college grads have the experience to make a difference? All that is coming up. Now, if you want to learn more about the DHS Division of Children and Family Services Director Cecil Blucher resigning, you might want to check out an article on our website that tells you all about that. It has statements from all the parties involved. But first, here we are joining up with a conversation on the DHS's handling of the Boonville Human Development Center. A report was issued this week by the group Disability Rights Arkansas showing some negligence there and some abuse. Here's KUAR's Jacob Kaufman picking up the conversation.
Disability Rights Arkansas has, for the past year or two, released two or three different reports about the Boonville Human Development Center because of an overuse, they allege, of physical restraints and chemical restraints if these people with developmental disabilities are not cooperating with whatever their daily living routine is or acting out in a certain way. So they wanted to interview this woman before she died because she said she'd been excessively restrained. They would strap you on a board, basically, for hours at a time if you overreacted or something like that. So here's Justin Nichols talking a little bit about why they were even looking at Boonville Human Development Center.
We actually discovered that this person had passed away after we were looking into the high number of restraints that were used at the facility as compared to the other human development centers. This one person had been restrained multiple times, and our monitors had hoped to question her about that.
Amy Webb, who's the spokesperson for the Department of Human Services, she says that they only use these restraints in emergency situations. They have no evidence of staff not following protocol or there being any systemic problem at this particular facility. And she even kind of suggested that, well, Disability Rights Arkansas wants this facility closed down, so maybe there's somehow, she's kind of suggested at least, it might be fitting towards their ultimate goal that they'd want this closed anyway.
While all this is going on, the state is still looking for a new director of the Department of Human Services as a whole. As we know, John Selig, the director since 2005, I believe, announced he was resigning. And DHS is one of the largest agencies in state government, if not the largest.
Steve Barnes calls it the Pentagon, actually.
Oh, really? Well, that gives you a sense of its scale. Do we know anything about how that search is going? What has Governor Hutchinson said about who he's looking for? Have there been any candidates floated out there?
Well, like Cecile Blucher's resignation, she's going to stay on while the governor transitions and finds this new director. And so that's been the case with John Selig as well. So he's announced his resignation a while back, but is staying until this process is complete. The governor said at a press conference that the interview process was completed. He interviewed three different candidates, and he said, I can't remember the exact quote, but he said in the near future, he's going to reveal who his choice is to be the replacement for John Selig.
All right.
So definitely, a clean slate at DHS all around. And, some people might allege that the governor maybe pushed Cecil Blücher out. You know, it's just a new beginning at DHS. But let me play one cut from him. He said that it came as a surprise to him. He claims, did not push for her resignation, and he said that she's qualified.
Cecil Blücher surprised us and submitted her resignation, but she was so gracious to be able to stay on through any transition. Cecile's been an extraordinary public servant.
So there's the governor.
Any ideas from either of you about who might succeed Cecil Blücher?
I'm not that well versed in, I guess, who their child welfare experts are that are out there that are available for this kind of job.
We'll tell you next week.
All right. Stay tuned, podcast listeners. We'll have that news when it arrives. All right. Moving on. This week, Jacob, there was some talk in Congress, especially in the U.S. Senate, after comments made by President Obama during his State of the Union address, that there might be a potential bill to reform mandatory minimums in sentencing laws, particularly for nonviolent drug offenders. However, our junior U.S. Senator, Tom Cotton, expressed his disappointment or ire this week with the possibility of reforming mandatory minimums on the federal level. And Jacob, you spoke with a couple of U.S. Senate candidates, or the incumbent, John Bozeman, mm-hmm. Republican from Northwest Arkansas, as well as his challenger, Democratic candidate Connor Eldridge, a former federal prosecutor, in fact, who one might expect would have a deep familiarity with sentencing laws and these kinds of issues. Could you first give us a little background about what has been floated in terms of ideas about these mandatory minimums and reforming them, and what Senator Cotton has said, and how these two candidates, Bozeman and Eldridge, have responded?
At this point, it's still pretty early. As you mentioned, this was kind of floated by the president's address, but this is an issue that's been kind of gaining in political traction, it seems, on both sides. There are some people who may be more conservative that fiscally they see prison populations as being unsustainable and damaging perhaps to the economy in the whole. And on the left, with the Black Lives Matter movement and generally criminal justice reform, you see a lot of people pushing for drug offenders and nonviolent offenders to get more kind of a treatment instead of a punishment or punitive system. So there's not too many specifics at this point. Senator Cotton's remarks were actually from a closed-door meeting, supposedly, and Politico magazine and website found out about it. There's some talk of eliminating some mandatory minimums for some people, but I think it's more leaning toward reducing some mandatory minimums, so that's kind of the compromise. They won't be so long. But John Cornyn, who's in the Senate leadership from Texas, a Republican senator as well, he said that Tom Cotton doesn't know what he's talking about, essentially claiming that violent offenders are going to get out on the street because of this. He says that's simply not what anyone is talking about that he's talking to anyway. So I caught up with both U.S. Senate candidates, Connor Eldridge and John Bozeman, at the winter meeting of the Arkansas Sheriff's Association. Here's Connor Eldridge. You know, he wanted to make it clear, I'd ask him maybe two or three times, that he really believes that mandatory minimums, as you mentioned, because he's a former U.S. attorney and a prosecutor, they're helpful in a lot of ways for him. He said for really violent offenders and people he thinks should go to jail for a long time. So he says they can be helpful, but he said maybe for some, there is some room for change.
For nonviolent first-time drug offenders, there ought to be some consideration as to the most realistic and best punishment for those offenders.
It's worth noting, though, at the tail end of this week, he released a press statement, one of his only policy statements, too, that I'm aware of, that he thinks that for even first time, a lot of sexual predators and sexual crime should get life in prison. So he wants to be very clear that he is hard on crime. John Bozeman also, you know, kind of vaguely said he's open to some reconsideration of mandatory minimums for nonviolent people.
If you've got somebody that's, you know, a very, very low-level criminal that hasn't participated in a violent crime, and there are instances of those, we need to fix that.
I also reached out to Frank Gilbert, the Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, and he was not so ambiguous about his beliefs about mandatory minimums, perhaps as his two major party competitors. He said that they should not exist. All they do is kind of strangle the decision-making power of local judges. He believes most power should be vested in local authorities.
All right, well, we'll see how this debate plays out in the U.S. Senate race in the coming months up until November 2016. So this week, the Arkansas Board of Health decided on some changes to abortion law regulations in the state, changing some key terms within the regulations. Sarah, you spoke with somebody on the Arkansas Board of Health who filled you in on some of the back and forth, the discussions that have been going on about this change. Could you just give us a little bit of background about these discussions?
Sure. Well, this has been a controversial political flare-up, sort of unexpected at the end of the week here. The state medical board issued a vote that some regulations surrounding abortion should remove terminology that says abortion is the death of an unborn child, and instead say the termination of a pregnancy. Several pieces of legislation that passed in the last session, sponsored by State Senator Jason Rapert and also Representative Justin Harris, used that language, and Senator Rapert has said explicitly that that's part of dehumanizing abortion, framing abortion as an inhumane act. And the way that women going to have an abortion might encounter this language is in certain release forms. One of the bills passed was that minors have to sign a release in order to have an abortion. And this unborn child terminology is in that paperwork. Otherwise, it's mostly in the language of regulations that most lay people would never see. But it's about the framing of an abortion. When is a fetus a child? And the state medical board, a committee on the board, unanimously voted to consider this issue because they were concerned from their medical perspective that the unborn child terminology was inaccurate. The board voted 12-6 to change the language, and I think six others did not vote. It was a wide majority, but it was not unanimous. About half the board was explicitly for it. I spoke with Dr. Anika Whitfield, who's a member of the state medical board, and just some context of her. She's a local doctor. She's also been politically active. She's been an outspoken against the state takeover of the Little Rock School District. She also was a leading proponent for the change of Confederate Boulevard to Springer Boulevard, named after a prominent African-American family in that neighborhood. So she's on the state medical board, and I got to speak with her today, and she explained the medical basis for their decision.
In the time frame that we spoke about this, which was probably maybe about 20 to 30 minutes in our meeting, many of us drew upon our own understanding of what a fetus means medically versus, again, the termination of a pregnancy. And so when you look at defining a child or an infant or a fetus, you know, you're looking at specific weeks of life. And termination of pregnancy means from the beginning. And so a fetus actually designates a specific time frame in the growth period after conception. And so basically termination of pregnancy is from conception until birth. So that term is a lot broader than one of the inclusion of fetus.
So Senator Rapert has said on Twitter that he would like to see all of these board members taken out of their positions, and the governor has spoken out and said that he will not support this. He has to approve any rules that agencies or boards put forward, so he presumably will not allow this language change to take effect.
Although she gave reasons that it was purely for medical reasons, that it might also, you know, just illustrate a key ideological difference between Republican lawmakers and a Republican governor, and perhaps folks on the medical board. Jacob, did you want to weigh in on some political aspects of this?
I just wanted to also mention, though, from the beginning of this, that you were saying the term itself, Senator Rapert defends it, and in some way that it's maybe even designed to discourage abortion. Is that kind of right?
That's what he said explicitly. That this is a long-term effort to dehumanize abortion. So he claims that intent and thinks that it's appropriate and right. And I have reached out to him and didn't get to speak with him yet today, or would have included him also.
Yeah, I think it was a week or two ago, whenever the 12-week abortion ban, the state law, was turned down by the United States Supreme Court without comment. But one part of that that stood was that doctors have to show the fetal heartbeat test to women. And he said that was also intentional, you know, to discourage abortion. And Rita Sklar, the ACLU director, said, you know, these laws are meant to just discourage women and are not necessarily based on medical evidence.
And of course, Senator Raypert was a big proponent of contesting the science behind the 24-week gestation period established by the U.S. Supreme Court, which the Supreme Court has upheld.
Well, we'll see how this plays out after the governor makes his decision on the board's action. All right, well, there is a major announcement this week at the governor's conference room. Asa Hutchinson was on hand with several others from the business community. Little Rock School Superintendent Baker Curris was there announcing an investment in Teach for America in Little Rock schools. Jacob, you covered this press conference. What was this investment all about, and what will it mean for the Little Rock School District?
Well, the investment, it's $6 million, $3 million from the governor's discretionary funds, and $3 million from private donors, supposedly all of whom live in Little Rock, though we won't get a publicly released name of donors. So Teach for America, it's a national program that brings really talented recent college graduates who don't have necessarily a traditional education license, a teaching license, and they might not have majored in anything education related. But Teach for America does some kind of rush training and has provisional licenses. And traditionally, they go into underserved areas. For right now, they're in five Arkansas counties, rural Delta type counties. And the idea is it's hard to get really good teachers in some of these struggling schools. But these are some bright young people who can do something. And so 215 teachers is the goal. 65 of them will be in Little Rock. This is over 3 years. 65 will be in Little Rock by year two or year three. And there's also some traditional teachers, Arkansas Education Association. They seem to be a little bit weary of this, but we'll get into that in a little bit. First, here's Jared Henderson with Teach for America, Arkansas. He kind of talked about the importance of Little Rock's business community in making this all happen.
It has inspired an extraordinary and unprecedented investment from business and philanthropic leaders in Little Rock. I'd like to personally thank Walter Hussman, Haskell Dickinson, and the McGeorge family, who took the lead and were the first to make a commitment to this effort.
Now, critics of the state takeover of the Little Rock School District for the last year have been saying this whole takeover and a lot of the problems with the district have been engineered by people in the Chamber of Commerce, investors, and newspaper editor like Walter Hussman, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette publisher, that all of these forces have been acting in concert. Here they are, and they'll say, yes, we're acting in concert, but we're doing something that's good. Here's Walter Hussman, publisher of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. He said he represents all these Little Rock donors, and he said that he thinks basically that youth and energy can amount to a lot. He equated it to the Peace Corps of his generation.
These are people who are intelligent, who are dedicated, and want to make a big difference, and a big difference for public school kids in America.
Joyce Elliott is a Democratic state representative from Little Rock. She's also been critical of the state takeover and said all of these forces are kind of acting in concert together. And she said, you know, it sounds nice to get young idealistic students. She says she admires these students. They're great people. She even says the district should maybe even take them in. But she says the real priority for struggling schools should be get the best teachers, the most experienced teachers. They're going to do a better job.
This misguided benevolence, it sounds as if we're doing something great for these poor kids who are very much in need. Well, if they're very much in need, are these the teachers that they need?
She said, especially in places like Little Rock, where this would be the first time that they're ever going into Little Rock School District, Teach for America, that it's not hard to get qualified teachers in the district per se. Maybe it is for certain schools. And she says she wishes these private donors and the governor would invest $6 million in trying to get good talent already in Little Rock to move from maybe better schools to worse schools. And she gave me three or four examples, once again, of why she thinks that Teach for America is not the ideal solution for struggling schools.
If you were getting on a plane and there were poor flying conditions, there is no way you would say, give me the pilot with the highest grade point average, hasn't flown that many miles, doesn't have the experience of the one that's been around for 10 or 12 years. We would never do that, but we do it to kids.
So she and people who are critical of this say that these Teach for America people will only end up going to poor schools. That's not really fair. The donors themselves, their children probably won't have to have these, I guess, like a second tier kind of qualification of teachers. Superintendent Baker Curris afterward confirmed that he believes they will only go to the six academically distressed schools, or at the very least, distressed schools.
Well, Sarah, you've covered the school district for quite a while. Do you have any knowledge of the prevailing sentiment among the teachers' union or existing teachers about how these kind of big decisions play out on the kind of local school-by-school level?
Well, this year, for the first time in about 50 years, the teachers' union signed a contract with the district that radically changed the nature of the bargaining rights of teachers, that involved issues of control over their day, their planning time, and also their health care benefits and salaries. The Little Rock School District teachers haven't gotten a raise. They did not ask for one last year because of the financial issues and leadership changes that the district's been undergoing. So I think that there's a trend to pay entry-level teachers a bit higher. I know the Jacksonville School District, newly formed school district, plans to pay entry-level positions higher than Pulaski County Special School District positions. That's the district they separated from. But when you get to the higher senior levels, the salaries flatten out. And so some teachers that were part of Pulaski County now are part of Jacksonville are actually losing that salary because the goal is to bring in young people, but not necessarily retain or pay teachers the value of their senior position. So I'm guessing that the teachers union would be concerned about the labor implications of bringing in young recent college graduates that will work for low wages without this experience, not valuing that experience. Jacob was at the announcement, so maybe he had the chance to actually speak to them firsthand.
Well, Joyce Elliott, she's a former educator herself, at least, and she's worked a lot with the Arkansas Education Association, been in the teachers union in the past. She pretty much straight up said that she thinks one reason is that these young teachers are more malleable. It's easier for districts and administrators to kind of push them around.
Of course, charter schools are another way that young teachers can be making less and have opportunities to get started. That obviously has an appeal for like a talented or academically successful young person. But from teachers' perspective, I guess one of those criticisms I hear about Teach for America, aside from that it's been a wildly successful endeavor, is that a lot of teachers burn out within the first 5 years. And a lot of these struggling schools, even with Teach for America, don't have the support for those staff without the experience to be dealing with the kind of systemic problems that they encounter, and that perhaps they don't have a life experience to be able to relate to their students. And so it's not always known to be the best experience for a first-time teacher either.
I was going to say, and this lack of licenses issue is another thing that's kept on coming up with people, especially critical of the state takeover of the school district. Teach for America doesn't have to have a traditional license, traditional education that most other teachers would. The superintendent, Baker Curris, also does not have the traditional qualifications to be a superintendent, and neither does Education Commissioner Johnny Key, who had all of those waived so he could be put in by Governor Asa Hutchinson. So that's another, teachers feel like it's a devaluation of their profession all the way through the Department of Education under this administration.
And Sarah, you mentioned the financial constraints that the district is facing. The desegregation payments by the state will be ending soon. And I think it might be interesting to see, or something to look out for, whether or not the school district will in the future be seeking more kinds of these private-public partnerships as a way of dealing with that loss of funding.
Well, certainly that's the premise of a charter school movement, as well as the foundation funds when charter schools get a fraction per every student from the public coffers that a public school would get. So seems to be the pattern we're seeing.
Jared Henderson with Arkansas's Teach for America called it a transformative, unprecedented investment from private donors in Teach for America, at least in Arkansas anyway. And Walter Hussman, he even said that this was the fastest he's seen Little Rock donors contribute to anything ever that he's tried to participate in before. So they claim there's an interest still, I guess.
I feel like the charter school is not directly related, so I'm kind of going off.
Well, it still speaks to the issue of private-public partnerships. I mean, even though they might be separate from the district, it's certainly a confluence of issues that is facing education in Central
private
Arkansas.
Entities, whether it's donors or schools, being a solution to this once public idea of education. It's the common thread.
Right. You have Ford Arkansas, the Walton Family Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation. And then, of course, the Walton Family Foundation funding yet again another round of charter schools this
year. And determining what qualification of teacher now is in what school in Little Rock, basically.
All right. Well, we'll keep you guys posted for further developments. Thanks for listening to the KUAR Week in Review podcast. Our esteemed news director, Michael Hiplin, should be back next week in the host's chair. But for now, thanks for listening. You can find us, of course, on iTunes as a podcast. You're probably listening on KUAR.org. Thanks for doing so. I'll thank you three or four more times before I end this outro.
But thanks for doing the theme music, Chris.
Oh, yeah. You're
welcome.
Thanks
for listening to this far into the podcast.
You've made it.
Yeah. All right. Well, KUAR is an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
We'll see you next week. Goodbye for now.